Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the show. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thanks for spending part of your day with us. You know the name Malcolm Gladwell from his writings for The New Yorker, a publication where he's been published since 1996, of course, for his best-selling books, such as The Tipping Point and Blink, and of course, his hit podcast, Revisionist History. Now he's embarking on a new line of inquiry and a brand new podcast he's co-producing with Bruce Hedlum, the former New York Times editor, as well as super music producer Rick Rubin. Rubin also happens to be the subject of the podcast's first episode. So let's play a little clip of him describing of Malcolm talking to Rick about what it took to get Run-DMC on board for that famous collaboration with Aerosmith.
Do you remember the reaction of Run-DMC themselves to this idea?
To walk this way?
Yeah.
Yeah, they were not into it.
They were not into it?
No.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you talk them into it?
I tried to talk them into it unsuccessfully. Russell really talked them into it. Russell said, just do what Rick says.
Russell Simmons, of course. The name of the podcast is Broken Records. Gentlemen, thanks for coming to the studio.
Delighted to be here.
Thank you.
What inspired you to start this podcast?
There's a bunch of different things going on simultaneously, but from my perspective, I had done some music shows for Revisionist History and just thought it was so much fun talking to musicians. I mean, I had never sort of spent any great amount of time with them and discovered that this was like, they're insanely interesting. And anytime you drag music into the conversation, the conversation gets more interesting. And Bruce was my oldest and dearest friend and as music obsessed as I am. And then I found out that Rick Rubin was interested in doing. So it was like a kind of natural, it all came together.
Bruce, when you thought about it, when you said, hey, I can do a podcast about music, I'm going to sit down and we're going to create this thing. What did you think your goals were? What did you want to achieve?
I think we wanted to do two things, which was tell stories. Most of the first season we're telling just in the form of interviews. But pretty much every episode, we had a question or a story in mind. The first person we had a performance from or we talked to was... And his name just flew out of my head.
Nile Rodgers.
I'm sorry.
Rodgers. Yeah.
This is why podcast is not live. Nile Rodgers, just by chance, I knew something about him, but I read his autobiography, which
is so good.
Unbelievable. Yeah. It's one of the great music autobiographies. I knew nothing about that, about him. He grew up in this unbelievably chaotic background. His mother was 13, and she was a sort of hipster, and he was periodically just sent across the country on a bus with a sandwich to go live with someone. And he was really someone who found a way of organizing his life through music, first in a high school band. He said all he ever wanted to be was like a clarinet player in an orchestra. And it informs the way he created Chic with his partner and he's done music after. And I just thought it was a fantastic story. The one that went up today is an interview with Roseanne Cash. And what interested me was I heard a couple tracks from the album, and other people said this to me. She's now in her 60s, and she's doing her best work. And there's not that many places other than public radio people hear it. So I thought that was just an interesting idea. She was at an age where, and we talked about this, where her father was struggling commercially. Mm-hmm. And so there was a kind of story there I wanted to hear. And I think the other part of it is, you know, there are great music critics. I worked at the Times for 19 years, and they've got some of the best. And we are not critics. I'm not going to try and beat them at their game. There are lots of people who write about pop music, but not many people talk about the meaning of music in their lives, either the people who produce it or people like Malcolm and I who are listeners. And that's what we wanted to emphasize.
Malcolm, do you have to be a music fan to listen to this podcast?
No, I don't think so. Although, you know, it's hard to find someone who isn't in some way touched by music. I mean, it's like saying, do you have to be a reading fan to read a book? We all sort of are reading fans. I mean, the podcast is deliberately eclectic. So it's really a way to discover, like Bruce was saying, he didn't know anything about Nile Rodgers before he did the Nile Rodgers, read the book and then talked to him. That's really, I want the position we want the listeners to be in. It's just a kind of really fun way to discover music you never thought you might like.
I'm curious, you mentioned you worked at the Times for 19 years and you work at the New Yorker. For this podcast, it's interesting. I've listened to all of them. You've traded sort of the capital J journalism for the conversational journalism. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, how has that transition been for you, Bruce?
It's very hard to put away the capital J, neutral voice of God that you learn at the New York Times. And in some ways, it's a hindrance when you're doing a podcast, which is so much more conversational. So a lot of the writing I've done when I've done introductions or something else, it really sounds like a New York Times lead that, you know, has a to be sure paragraph and, one of those is seen to be sort of sentence constructions. And honestly, the first couple episodes I wrote, the narrative ones, were just terrible. So you have to unlearn some of those lessons. Now, the good side is I worked with some of the smartest journalists in the world for 19 years and loved it. And they were just a group of incredibly smart, curious people, and that rubs off. So the good part of it certainly outweighs the sort of bad stentorian voice that really gets deep down in your soul, and it's very hard to exercise.
How about for you, Malcolm?
I don't know. I just have so much. This is like a vacation for me. So the next week's episode is a discussion with Dave Hill, who's an old friend of mine, about Norwegian black metal. And
this is the Dave Hill Show, Dave Hill?
Yes, of course. Basically consists of him talking and me laughing. I don't really do anything except laugh for the entire, and one of the most hilarious hours of, or interview
audio
I've ever done.
Yeah.
I've ever done. I mean, this is not the mode I'm in when I'm interviewing people for my books. So this is this great little chance just to do something for the pure pleasure of it.
We're speaking with Malcolm Gladwell and Bruce Hedlund about their new podcast called Broken Record. I want to play a little bit of the Rufus Wainwright episode because it was really interesting. He was very open about not having success in New York initially. Tell me a little bit about where you interviewed him and what you wanted to get out of that interview, Bruce.
I interviewed him at Sunset Studios in Sunset in Los Angeles. He drove down. He lives nearby and came in with his guitar. He had a very bad cold that day. We like to have people perform a song and then talk to them. It's a much more natural way to do that. We have people usually perform five songs. He did all his performances and then we spoke afterwards because he was worried about his voice. A lot of people, because Rufus also writes operas, and a lot of people have written about how his pop sensibility influences his operas. I was interested in the other way around, how his love of opera, which is very deep and very comprehensive, has affected his pop writing. But along the way, he told a lot of stories about being unsuccessful when he was young. You know, his mother, Malcolm and I grew up in Canada, where his mother and aunt are musical royalty, the McGarrigle sisters, these fabulous, songwriters. I think the initial lead was something, Elton John has called Rufus Wainwright the greatest songwriter in the world, but he may not be the greatest songwriter in his family. His father's Loudon Wainwright, of course. And so he just opened up about what it was like back then.
Let's take a little listen.
At the time, I was living at the Chelsea Hotel, and I had, it's funny because I went to New York earlier on before my first record. My dad had always, Loudon Wainwright III, he'd always lived in New York. And so I went down there and, slummed around and really had a terrible time. Nobody got me. It was at the time that Jeff Buckley was on the rise, and I'd go to this place, Shanae's, in the Lower East Side, and I gave them my tape three times. They refused it three times. They gave it back to me three times, and just New York did not embrace me at all. And so I left, and then I ended up coming to Hollywood and doing it there and making my first record. Anyways, so then I came back to New York having made a record and being, being well known and sort of the hot new guy on the block. And of course, everybody loved me. Everybody wanted to have a piece of me. Everybody, I was suddenly king of the city. And that's when I wrote Poses.
That's so interesting because Chennai was the place you had to play in New York at the time to be mm-hmm. taken seriously, to be considered, you know, sort of a critical darling.
Yes, and he just couldn't crack
that's
that.
It's amazing when you think about that.
Yeah, even with his father's help, I think. And it's interesting, Roseanne Cash was similar in that mm-hmm. she made her first record in Germany, you know, far from her father's influence, and I'm not sure that went very well. So I think that's a struggle almost anybody can appreciate.
Malcolm, you said earlier that you are the choice of artists is deliberately eclectic. Mm-hmm. So what do they all have in common? When you guys sit down and you make your list of who we want to talk to, what is it about an artist that is the right artist for this particular podcast?
I think it's, well, you just said it. It's who we want to talk to. It's like, who do you want to hang out with for an hour, right? I mean, it doesn't really, when you're having a conversation with somebody, you don't discriminate on the basis of the particular genre they belong mm-hmm. to. I don't say I'll never talk to poets, or I'll only talk to novelists. So we're the same way. It's like whose music would also benefit from having a discussion around it. So that, you know, like next week with Dave Hild, have I ever listened to death metal or black metal in my life? No. But do I want to have a conversation about it? Actually, it turns out I do. It's totally fascinating. So there's once you understand that you're playing the songs, but then you're going to talk about the songs, then I know Bruce is and I am, but also listeners are going to be far more open to a wider range of music. And the other thing is, we haven't talked about Rick. Rick Rubin, his sensibility is what this show is about. And Rick Rubin is someone who does not have boundaries in his life about music. He likes all music. He's produced, I mean, everything from Adele to, you know, to the most hip-hoppy of hip-hop. Mm-hmm. So he's not, so that's the idea we're coming at this with, which is that any music that is intelligent and thoughtful and imaginative is worthy of conversation. Mm-hmm.
The most hip-hoppy of hip-hop was our original tagline for the show. I want
to put that out. It's a good T-shirt.
Yeah,
it's a good
really
T-shirt. Good merch.
That wasn't a terribly felicitous way of describing hardcore hip hop.
But it was a fun way, though. We all know what you meant. Yeah. We're talking to Malcolm.
It's gangs delicious.
Now you're getting ridiculous. Right. We're talking to Malcolm Gladwell and Bruce Headlam about their new podcast, Broken Record. So Malcolm, in a recent episode, Bobby Braddock, he was on
yes.
your other podcast,
yes.
Revisionist History. So for people who have heard that, yeah. can you describe how you approached that differently for that podcast versus this current
one? Well, I talked to Bobby Braddock twice for Revisionist History, both in the service of telling a larger story in which he plays a, you know, one was about, called The King of Tears, and it was all about why is country music so adept at communicating strong emotion. Mm-hmm. And the other one was this song, this crazy episode about Elvis and the song he couldn't sing about parapraxis. And Bobby shows up in the middle of that. But on neither occasion did I talk to him directly about his craft. And so I thought I would be really fun to do an episode of Broken Record where I sat down with Bobby and I asked him to bring two of his songwriting pals from Nashville, Don Henry and Don Schlitz, two of the greats.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is like the Nashville dream team we gathered together. And I just had them talk about they were all part of the sort of songwriting revolution in Nashville in the 70s and 80s. And just had them talk about what that meant. And I loved it. The conversation was just fantastic. It went on for hours. We could have run hours of it. I mean, we had to sort of painfully cut it back.
Yeah, one of the things I thought was really interesting in that episode was them discussing how the songs they wrote and the type of country songs they wrote then couldn't be successful now because it took so long to get to the hook.
The Gambler
being
the great example that the Gambler doesn't, you don't understand what's going on until verse, whatever it is, mm-hmm. verse two or verse. And the same thing with Bobby Braddock's great George Jones song, He Stopped Loving Her Today, where the payoff is not until the very end. And there was sort of a fascinating point that today the song has to declare itself right away. Back then, in fact, there's a wonderful line I think Don Henry said, which is they used to tell you to take your first verse and turn it into your second verse. They wanted the delayed payoff. I just thought it was fascinating.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring in another clip from Rick Rubin. He's actually mentioned in your most recent episode as being a great help to Johnny Cash's creative practice. So let's take a listen to this clip and talk about it on the other side.
Rick came in like a spirit brother, and my whole family, I think, owes him a huge debt for what he did for Dad. I mean, it was such a redemptive act.
We should mention you're talking about Rick Rubin.
Yeah, Rick Rubin, sorry.
Who's one of the partners in this podcast.
Yeah.
And produced, I think, all your father's last five albums.
The American Recordings, yeah.
Which are, of course, sort of landmarks.
Yeah. I always thought of Dad like Matisse, you know, like Matisse starting with representational art and going into impressionistic, and then this burst of creativity at the end of his life, you know, when he did the Jazz Dancers. It's like he kept reinventing himself. And I think that fallow period on Mercury when he did all that kind of really, some really shallow and pedestrian recordings, then he just burst open when Rick came on the scene.
Well, Rick gave him permission to be the artist he really was, and not sort of a musical artist plugged into some sort of song/hit-making Nashville machinery, which at that point was just a very bad fit for your father.
You know?
I mean,
he needed someone to say,
"You're an artist.
You're Johnny Cash.
What are you doing? You're Johnny Cash. Let go of all of this. Let's just sit you down with the guitar, just you and the guitar, and let's get back to the basics."
And you know what's sort of fun as a listener of your podcast is Rick Rubin in the first episode talks about working with Johnny Cash.
Yes, yeah.
Can you share a little bit about that? Because it felt like a really nice book. I mean, I know this isn't your last episode, but it was an interesting callback.
Yeah. Yeah, no, because when I was chatting with Rick for our episode one, we started with his sort of early days in hip hop, and then I was sort of interested in how far he traveled from that, and we talked about Johnny Cash. And he had this wonderful moment where he talked about that there was two Johnny Cashes. There's the kind of iconic Johnny Cash, and then there was who Johnny Cash was as a person. And I thought he was going to say, my role as a producer was to show you the authentic Johnny Cash. And he said the exact opposite, that my role as a producer was to recapture the iconic Johnny Cash. And I love that the instinct that you wanted to see the man in all his frailty is actually wrong. Mm-hmm. What you really want to see is the kind of artistic self that he created for himself, which had been diminished by this kind of mediocre work. And what Rick was doing was letting the kind of the genius reassert himself. And I thought that that's a beautiful encapsulation of Rick's genius as a producer. That's what he does. I think he allows the iconic artist to surface.
And also that idea of how different a song can be and the meaning of a song can be hurt, I'm thinking of.
Oh, yes.
Depending upon who's singing it and at what point they are in their life, and how it's a sort of a more tragic song when Johnny Cash is singing it.
Oh, sung by a 70-year-old as opposed to a 20-year-old, it's a different. The song there's no relationship between those two versions. I don't think one is better than the other. They're just different songs. I mean, it's an extraordinary sort of insight to have to say, oh my goodness, Johnny Cash in that kind of broken down voice singing Hurt would be an entirely new creation.
Yeah, it's devastating sometimes if you're in a certain mood and you listen to it.
I know, yes.
It really is.
It should come with a warning label.
Exactly.
It is funny you picked out that quote, though, because I deliberately did not ask Roseanne Cash about her father.
And she volunteered it.
She did. Well, the conversation went that way. We were talking about both her parents. But, you know, she is this, I think she's now 63. She's had this almost 40-year career. She actually was rejected by Nashville before her father. She did an album called Interiors, which is, I think, one of the great albums ever made. In 1990, and was said, yeah, we can't play this on the radio. And she's like, really? Because it seems pretty good to me. So I really wanted to deal with her, I thought, on her own. I think she's probably a person who gets a little sick of the first line of every, you know, review or article says, daughter of Johnny Cash. And, you know, she is her own person, and she's a incredibly fascinating, super smart person.
She's super smart.
She's great to talk to. And that was, by the way, her husband in there, John Leventhal, who is just a heartbreaking guitar and piano player. Apparently he plays all instruments. He's one of those irritating people, but I wanted to point that out. So they both played for us in studio, and it was wonderful.
Can you tell us who else is coming up? We've got Dave Hill. Who else?
Well, we have a bunch of stuff stashed away for next season.
Oh, okay.
We have a wonderful Robbie Robertson interview. We have...
Oh, I could just listen to him, like, read a phone book.
We have...
That voice.
No, he's amazing. We have Ezra Koenig of Vampire Weekend coming when his new album comes. Cool. We have some other stuff I can't reveal.
I'll take the two of them. The name of the podcast is Broken Record. You can check out Malcolm Gladwell and Bruce Hedlund's new podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
And Rick Rubin. Yeah.
Malcolm, Bruce, thank Rick for us as well. Right. Thanks for coming to the studio.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Allison.
When we come back, we'll talk to the author of the book, Gowanus, Brooklyn's Curious Canal, and get an update on the cleanup efforts at the canal, as well as the de Blasio administration's push to build affordable housing alongside that creek. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. We'll be right back. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. Believe it or not, the Gowanus Canal is cleaner than it's been in 150 years. Well, a section of it anyway. And don't take it from me, take it from the EPA, which has just wrapped up one of its first major phases of the toxic Brooklyn waterways, long in the making cleanup. And if you listen to the EPA, we might be coming up at a time when the body of water the Brooklyn paper calls the borough's nautical purgatory might just become Brooklyn's nautical paradise. Sound too good to be true? Here to walk us through the canal's cleanup and provide us with a little bit of context along the way is author Joseph Alexiou. His first book, Gowanus, Brooklyn's Curious Canal, was published by NYU Press in 2015. Welcome to All of It, Joseph. Thanks for coming to the studio.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
All right, so I stumbled across this article in the headline late last month, EPA, Gowanus Canal, cleaner than it's been in 150 years. Is that truth or truthiness? Or
it's technically true. I've tried to come up with a good parallel, and it's kind of like saying, well, let's say you have a teenager, and 2 years before they became a teenager, they had no pimples on their face, and now they have many, and then because they started taking Accutane, they have two less. And it says, your face is cleaner than it has been in years, is what that means.
Okay, that's a visual. All right, so when we're talking about clean, as we're defining clean, what does that really mean in terms of the canal?
Right. Well, why it's a superlative, why the EPA head engineer deemed this cleaner than it has been is because they finished a pilot project, which successfully executed what they are going to do, which is remove all of the toxic sludge that sits at the bottom of the canal. And so they removed all the way down to the base of the canal and then capped it with seven layers of protective sort of materials, and then created an environment on top of that cap with gravel for things to grow. And so they have proved that their project works, and then they can apply this to the rest of the canal. So they removed a huge amount of stuff, about 4 million gallons, and barged it away, and that was barely. They said that's 10,000 square yards, cubic yards, and they have to remove about 500,000 cubic yards.
Wow.
Yes.
So what is the price tag on all of this?
What a good question. Well, the original budget for this project was $500 million.
Half a billion.
And that was the full cleanup, which included building several tanks to capture raw sewage, which is a whole other.
Oh, we'll get there.
Okay, sorry to skip ahead. I don't want to. There's a lot, you know, there's a lot of things in there.
So $500 million.
Mm-hmm. And the truth is that the city has since, New York City has since appropriated about $2 billion to complete some phases of the project, which is rather interesting. So what is the final price tag? If I had to guess, we're looking at more than that. I would say at least three, maybe even five. You know, it depends on how things go in cities.
All right. Let's roll back and do a little bit of a history lesson. How did the Gowanus Canal get so polluted in the first place?
Fantastic. It's like a great question. My one word answer is progress. And the way that I get there is that this was a naturally occurring body of water, tidal estuary surrounded by salt marshes. And once Brooklyn became bigger and bigger in the 1840s, they needed that land to build houses. So they needed to drain the swamp, so to speak. And then once they drained it, they hooked up sewers to it. And once that was finished, they had 50 different kinds of factories built along its shores. It had canal boats going, barges going in and out every day, dropping coal and oil and everything. And so it's the industry that polluted it. And the biggest polluter by far, the real answer to your question is that Gowanus was the epicenter of the gas, coal to gasification sort of energy creator of Brooklyn in its era. The three largest gas plants in New York at one point were along the Gowanus Canal shores, and they dumped an incredible amount of coal tar deep into the canal bed and under the ground. And we're talking hundreds of feet down.
So were there environmentalists along the way during this process, or did progress just outweigh everything else at this time in history?
Well, the environmentalism didn't really exist back then. When I say progress, it was about, you know, the conceit of mankind, I believe, or people kind nowadays, is that we want to control our environment and be in control. And that's what a 19th century industrialist did. We were making more progress than we ever had, and more people had freedom and jobs and autonomy. They weren't tied to agriculture. And so this was their way of creating the most jobs and the most living conditions for the most people, was to engineer this into a useful neighborhood.
So in a sense, it wasn't, not that we can be in their mind, it was, they weren't doing it out of sort of deliberate malfeasance. They weren't like, oh, let's just mess with this canal. Nobody will ever ask us. They considered themselves at the time helping to create this great place called Brooklyn.
They were doing it for money.
Yeah, well.
But, you know, creating Brooklyn was a big part of it. And the big players, the big investors, they really did have a legacy in mind, for sure. And that is part of why people do things. It's not just for the money. It is to say, I did that, and I'm responsible for that, and I helped create this city. For sure.
We're speaking with Joseph Alexiou, author of Gowanus, Brooklyn's Curious Canal, because I saw an article and I couldn't go to sleep without knowing the answer about whether the Gowanus Canal is the cleanest it's been in 150 years. So in every article you read about, they talk about, quote, the black mayonnaise at the bottom of the canal. What's the black mayonnaise?
Oh, so much fun. Black mayonnaise is a true combination of some of the most disgusting things you can think of. First of all, it is everything that gets flushed down a toilet or poured down a sink into the canal is this kind of biomaterials, fecal matter, any number of things. And then that combines with all the toxic materials that slip into the canal. So oil, engine oil, and chemicals that are on the sidewalks. And then the coal tar that's floating around or really on the bed of the canal. They're almost attracted to each other with this magnetism. And so you've got mostly coal tar and then other things like NAPL or non-aqueous phase liquid, which is just things like bleach and hairspray. And then you've got heavy metals.
I think they're insulting mayonnaise.
I think they are. I think a black mayonnaise could be delicious. And why they haven't marketed it yet, I don't know.
Somebody mix a little caviar? No.
It slides off the shovel is the point.
Gotcha.
And the last story, and I'll stop, is that the EPA, when they first took some of this black mayonnaise, and this is like a decade ago, and put it in a plastic jar on a shelf the day after testing it, they went in the next day to the laboratory and it had melted the plastic completely.
Wow.
Corrosive, toxic material.
Wow. So at what point was the canal first recognized as a problem?
I think, the first mention I have in the book ever dating back to, like, you know, pollution problems at the canal is approximately 1861. But it was really in 1879, my favorite headline about the canal, Gowanus Canal, the disgusting conditions of the Gowanus Canal. And that was because there were shoals or sandbars of waste coming out of the sewers that were so high that it reached above the water and people couldn't navigate their barges.
Wow.
So really, we're talking about 140 years ago.
That's amazing. All right. I promised you we'd talk about sewage. Mm-hmm. I knew we'd get back here. So a big part of this problem was because of the combined sewer overflow, mm-hmm, right? That's what the CSO,
that's
what the kids call it. Mm-hmm. This is supposedly like an intractable feature of New York City's sewer system. Is that a fair assessment?
Would you say retractable?
No, intractable.
Oh, intractable. Sorry. You know, it is a very expensive thing to rebuild an entire sewer system. Mm-hmm. This is the original sewer system of Brooklyn being sort of expanded and built upon. Actually, one of the first organized sewer systems to be designed by an engineer in the whole country. So at the time, it was state of the art. And it is a ongoing problem because there's always going to be more water than there will be sewer pipes. It's just a question of numbers. You can't possibly move it all out of the way. So we have to manage it. It is fixable with enough money.
So if you had enough money, what are some of the options that have been put on the table?
Well, in order to stop the raw sewage, the EPA officially had designated a cleanup plan that involved two tanks, 8 million gallons, 4 million gallons, to put them at the worst outfalls of the canal. And they would capture all of the rain. Basically, when it rains, the first 20-25% of what comes out of the canal is just raw sewage that's been sitting there, all of the street runoff that has engine oil. Mm-hmm. And so these tanks are meant to capture all of that and pump it back into the treatment system once that's, you know, finished. And only in like maybe 9 out of every 10 rain events or 2 out of the 10 does the water get so huge that it would just overflow to a ridiculous amount. We're talking about like million gallon overflow in a couple of hours or minutes even. And so the tanks should capture that. Mm-hmm. Most recently, the city has proposed an alternate plan, which is to dig a tunnel that would carry the water out of those areas and put it in the treatment plant instead of the tanks, which is rather interesting that they're throwing this out at sort of the 11th hour, mm-hmm. you could say.
Is that plan getting any traction?
Well, it's too early to tell. I can say that there is definitely some questions from the EPA about how effective it would be and whether or not this is a good idea. It's so early that the community hasn't even had a chance really to respond to it. And we haven't seen any numbers about except how many millions of gallons it would hold, which has gone from 17 to 16 in the last like 48 hours.
And the reason the EPA is so up all in this is because this was declared a Superfund site, right, in 2010.
That's right. So the EPA actually oversees this entire cleanup, and the federal oversight provides a whole team of people that have great experience in environmental engineering. And they're the ones that are directing the cleanup, and they are the ones that are sort of organizing it. But they don't make all the calls, they don't make all the shots. And that's unique to a lot of places, but especially New York.
We're talking to Joseph Alexiou about his book, Gowanus, Brooklyn's Curious Canal. Actually, his book is helping us understand this headline that we saw in the Brooklyn paper that said the Gowanus Canal is the cleanest it's been in 150 years. Okay, so you've probably heard, I know you know this. I had somebody invite me to a birthday party at a bar on the Gowanus Canal. Oh. And I was like, huh, a bar. So that area is ripe. People want to develop it, right?
Oh,
the city wants
yeah.
to develop it, right?
Oh, my goodness. They already have.
They're
they
all
have
up in
been.
It.
They were all up in it. Was it Lavender Lake that you were at?
Maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Lavender Lake is what they used to call the canal for the oil sheen. Now it's the name of a cute restaurant in Gowanus. That is absolutely a very hot area. This happens in areas where things are, quote unquote, underdeveloped. There were a lot of empty lots, abandoned buildings, or underused buildings in the area. And when there's a lack of space, which is perpetual in New York, then any area like that, once the surrounding neighborhoods become cool enough and expensive enough, mm-hmm. then they start to look, well, what's the next step? And Gowanus is perfect in many ways because its polluted status has kept it underdeveloped, and now there are many tax breaks to developers to develop these pieces of land. So they have this very strange attraction to people. Plus, the people that hang out in that neighborhood live there, work there, artists, you know, also all kinds of, you know, auto workers. There's a really wide range of businesses. You know, they also create this combined environment of commercial, industrial, and residential life that is like the Jane Jacobs idealist utopia of New York. The cool buildings. I could go on forever.
But there is an issue, though, because they're still trying to clean the canal. And, for example, the Whole Foods
yes.
had a really big issue as a result. As it's trying to build itself up, this is not pro or con Whole Foods.
Right.
There was an issue with infrastructure.
Oh, I was there this morning, so I got to look at it.
Oh, tell me.
Yeah, so I went to the Whole Foods this morning because that strip of cleanup happened right next to it, and it happened in this basin, which is called the 4th Street Basin. And I can say with 100% accuracy that collapse of the bulkhead, in which part of the walkway and parking lot of the Whole Foods collapsed into the canal, was because of shoddy engineering and subcontracting that wasn't really vetted well.
Hmm.
And this is, unfortunately, I will say this, like, this is a thing about the city, is that they love to save money. It's always about money. And they will subcontract out to people and not really oversee what happens there. As it is, the Whole Foods parking lot is built on a swamp wetland, and it still has plenty of toxic waste under it, and is also kind of shifting and settling.
And buckling.
It's buckling. It's like putting... It's like putting something hard on top of a thing of Jell-O.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing you say is as this evolves, they need to be incredibly careful with what they do and how they do it.
The thing about progress is that we do our best at the time. And then we look back and say, oh, my Lord, what were we thinking? And so, they want to do the best they can for the community. And that it means cleaning it up. And that would mean afterwards using the land for something useful. But how much can we ever clean up this land is what needs to be clear. They can never truly make it clear. 9 out of 10, sewage events will still end up in the canal. That means that you can never swim in it because at least once a year, there's a whole huge flush. And then the toxic waste under the ground, under the canal bed, in the land surrounding the canal, plumes that reach down more than 100 feet of toxic waste that would cost billions to remove, not to mention the thousands of trucks that it would take to truck it all out of the community, the disruption, and the fact that it's one of the most densely populated toxic waste sites in the country.
What question haven't I asked you that I should have asked you about this?
I would like to hear from the media, what do we think about affordable housing, and what do we think about building 100% affordable housing on the banks of the canal, on the site of one of the most toxic manufactured gas plants to ever historically be in this country?
That's an undercovered issue.
I would say so. I would say there is a place called Public Place, which is a site that was given to the public in 1974 after being polluted over the course of more than 100 years by manufactured gas. And the city is intent on, and Bill de Blasio is intent on building 700 more units of affordable housing on that site, pending a cleanup. And, what they're not saying is that there will always be toxic waste under the ground. We're going to have to smash into it to build these apartments. And is this an appropriate place to build affordable housing, especially since it's also a flood zone? Why have we given out the contract to the developer to administer this without a zoning change? Why are we 5 steps ahead of this problem when it is truly toxic? And the community deserves to know all of the truth about how much affordable housing works, what the numbers are in the Gowanus developments that have already gone up, mm-hmm. and whether or not the community should ask, what else can we use this space for? Is it appropriate to have people live here? This is what everyone assumes, oh, it's going to get cleaned up, it's going to get cleaned up. Well, that headline shows you that what do we think of as clean? Technically, it's cleaner, but is it going to be clean? Would you live on this, elected official? Would your kids live on this? And then maybe, also, if this wasn't New York City, if every story in the city wasn't a real estate story, would we even consider building on this? If this was the suburbs, there'd be a fence around it.
The name of the book is Gowanus, Brooklyn's Curious Canal. Joseph Alexiou, thank you so much for sharing your reporting and your expertise. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
When we come back, we'll talk to Lebanese actor and filmmaker Nadine Labaki. Her newest project is a film called Capernaum. Stay with us. All of it will be back after a quick break. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We're joined now in studio by director, actor, and screenwriter Nadine Labaki. Her new film, Capernaum, presented by Sony Pictures Classic, has just been nominated for a Golden Globe in the Best Foreign Film category, and it recently took home the Grand Jury Prize from Cannes. Capernaum, filmed over a 6-month period in Lebanon, tells the plight of children who face extreme poverty and neglect from their parents. In the film, a young boy, Zane, sues his mother and father for, quote, the crime of having conceived him. The characters in Capernaum are not played by professional actors, and in fact, many of the actors' realities closely resemble the lives of the characters they portray in the film. Capernaum opens in New York and L.A. this Friday, December 14th, at the Landmark at 57 West and Film Forum. Vulture at New York Magazine has said of the film, prepare to be blown away. Nadine, welcome to All of It, and congratulations on the accolades.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I said to you before you sat down that this film, there's just a lot to take in.
Yeah.
And that's important because it's dealing with difficult issues, and the storytelling really draws you in. So we meet Zane. He's in this courtroom. He's in handcuffs. We follow him through his harrowing and young life and what he has to do to survive. So you spent 3 or 4 years researching this film, is
yes.
that right? What were you looking for in your research? What did you want to discover?
In the beginning, you know, I felt I was not entitled to imagine the story. And of course, what drew me into that story and into wanting to tell that story was really the sight of all these children living in Lebanon with the Syrian refugee crisis. And, you know, Lebanon has hosted over 1.5 million refugee Syrian refugees over the past year. So the situation is really hard for Lebanese and for Syrians. And the sight of children deprived from, you know, their most basic rights, children working, children begging, children on the streets, homeless, children working, carrying very heavy loads, is something that is almost part of our everyday life. And it's like an accumulation of things. And over the past few years, we've been confronted with those images of children over the internet, whether, you know, I don't know if you remember the child, Alan Kurdi, that was found dead on the shores of mm-hmm. Turkey. And I that remember image. Very well, you know, thinking, if this child could talk, what would he say? What would he tell the world? Who's put him in this situation, the adults who have failed him, because this is what we're doing, unfortunately, every day. We are failing these children, and they are paying the highest price for our faults, our decisions, our conflicts, our wars,
our inaction.
Inaction and governments and inactive governments and stupid decisions and you know, systemic chaos. And I thought, you know, what goes on in the heads of those children? What is going on in the head of this child that is standing next to my car window, looking at me, not looking at him? Because this is what we usually do, unfortunately. We're facing such a problem that sometimes we feel like the only way is just to escape it and just to be completely oblivious to it. And those children are not only psychologically invisible or almost non-existent, they're even legally non-existent, because most of them are not even registered. Mm-hmm. Most of them are born and die without anybody knowing that they were even there. And they are living, you know, in those belts of misery surrounding our lives and our societies, hanging there without having any right to anything, no right to education, no right to health, no right to work, no right to travel, no right to, and they just live there, you know, on the fringes of our lives. And I thought, in a way, I want to become their voice. I want to be the vehicle for them to express themselves. And I started this research, that took like 3 to 4 years, and just going to the most unfortunate places in Lebanon, talking to children, talking to hundreds and thousands of children. And I used to ask them one question at the end of the conversation, which is, are you happy to be alive? And we're talking about children who've been facing extreme neglect. Unfortunately, most of the times the answer is no. I'm not happy to be alive. Mm. I don't belong in your world. You don't deserve us. I don't know why I'm here, if I'm going to be raped and abused and beaten up every day, never going to hear a nice word, never going to eat when I'm hungry. Why? Why am I here? Why? Like, there's always this angry why. And in a way, I wanted to translate this anger. And it was like all of a sudden, this idea of this child who's going to stand in front of the world. Because when he's standing
to his parents,
yes,
like
his parents.
He has this sense of like, I'm going to do something
about it,
this situation, and here's what I'm going to do.
I'm going to say stop. You can't do this to me anymore, and you can't do this to this next child that is coming into this world. If you can't be responsible enough to have me. And he's not only talking about to his parents. He's talking to the whole world. I mean, through his parents, obviously he's talking to the society. Mm-hmm. If you can't be up to the responsibility, you can't have us. You don't deserve us. You have to be, you know, up to that responsibility. You know, it's really thinking about the sacred nature of those children. We can't keep doing this. Mm-hmm. We can't be oblivious to the plight that they're going through. And it's, we're talking about millions of children across the world. We're not only talking about hundreds or thousands of children. We're talking about millions. Like, there's 280 million child across the world who is now working to feed his family.
And that happens in the film. The young boy, Zane, his sister is sold off to be married, and he ends up helping another refugee by taking care of her small baby while she goes and works, and they're all concerned about being arrested, and the film is all about what they have to do to survive. And the wisdom in this little boy who plays Zane, who is actually a refugee, right?
Yes, he's a Syrian refugee.
First of all, how did you find him, and how is he doing?
He's doing great. Before telling you how he's doing right now, we found Zane on the streets in Lebanon. He was playing with his friends. Zane is a Syrian refugee. He's been living in Lebanon for the past 8 years in very difficult circumstances. He flew the war. And then he was living in one of those slums that you see in the film. And he grew up on the streets, obviously. He's never been to school, so the street was his school. So this is where he learned the violence. This is where he learned how to fight to exist, how to, you know, struggle to exist, how to be smart and outsmart the people who abused him or who mistreated him. He's a tough boy. He's you know, more adult than you and me. He's very wise. So it was obvious when we met him that it was going to be Zane. And now, like, you know, Capernaum means chaos and miracles. And miracles keep happening throughout this whole adventure. And now Zane is in Norway with all his family. He's going to school for the first time in his life. He's been resettled there. And he has a beautiful house overlooking the sea. He's playing in a garden and in the forest. He's not playing with, you know, knives and sharp objects anymore. And it's a new beginning in a way. It's a new, completely different shift, new destiny in a way.
Why did you choose not to use professional actors?
Because I think that cinema can have a much more, I think, a bigger impact on you as a viewer when you know that the struggle that you're seeing on the big screen is actually a real struggle. And it's a real boy living the same circumstances. It's not an actor who's acting the part or is being somebody else for the film. It was very important for me that they just be. They don't act. They just be who they are in a certain situation that we have created, obviously, and capture their reality and navigate it towards the fiction that we had written. So it was very important for me. I know that it has a completely different impact on you as a viewer when you leave that movie theater knowing that you've left this boy or this man or this woman there with their struggle, and you know that this is their struggle in real life. I think it does ignite in you some kind of a will to act or to change something. You don't leave the movie theater the same person. So I was betting on that.
Yeah, at least interested in knowing more.
Yeah.
You know, knowing, just
acknowledging
knowing
the
more.
Problem. Of yes.
We're speaking to Nadine Labaki about her film Capernaum. There's so many questions I want to ask you. So many questions. Was part of the film improvised?
Yes, a lot of the film was improvised. Of course, there's a very solid script, and you cannot improvise, I think, unless you know your material very well. And this is where you can have wings to just do what you want, because you know you're going to land somewhere that is very safe and strong, that is your script. So yes, we were improvising along the way a lot, because it's impossible for a non-actor to, you know, be prepared to come prepared to the shoot or to come with, you know, the script in their heads. And so I had to adapt to their own personality, to their own nature, to their own rhythm. Sometimes you can't expect, especially when you're working with children, you can't expect them to do what you want them to do when
exact,
you want them to do it. So
time.
Sometimes things would happen that were completely unexpected, and sometimes we would go with that flow and go explore something else and then go back to the scene that we were supposed to shoot. And sometimes things would happen that were very adequate to something but not to the scene that we were actually shooting. So we shoot it and then we incorporate it in a different scene. So we had to be very free and not be scared, you know, by the classical way of making films. That's why we shot for so long. That's why we decided to produce it ourselves. My husband produced the film, and he doesn't have any experience in producing. My husband is a music composer. So he did the music for the film, but he also produced it. So it was a very organic organic adventure where we were just listening to what the film needed, and we went. So the first edit of the film is 12 hours. We have 500 hours of rushes. So it's like, it was an amazing adventure that really like changed us as human beings, I think.
And I think anyone who sees the film will be changed by it. I'm very serious. It was extremely moving. I've been thinking about it nonstop since I've seen it. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And a job well done. The name of the film is Capernaum. Nadine Lebecki was our guest. Thanks for listening to All of It. We'll catch you on the other side of the news.